This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross.
In the criminal justice system, the people are represented by two separate yet equally important groups: the police who investigate crime and the district attorneys who prosecute the offenders. These are their stories.
After 20 years on NBC, Law & Order ends its run this month, but spin-offs continue, including a new one next season set in Los Angeles. Here's a scene from the first episode of the original Law & Order. The detectives are George Zunza and Chris Noth. The guest star is John Spencer.
Where was she murdered?
I told you, Urban Medical Center.
I'm sorry, Mr. Morton, I'm a little confused. Your daughter was killed at the hospital?
Yeah, in the emergency room, and I want to swear out a murder complaint against the resident in charge of it.
This resident was treating her?
No, killing her.
But she was at the hospital for treatment.
Yeah, a sore throat, muscle aches. She only went in to get a prescription for some antibiotics.
Well, sometimes people are a lot sicker than they look.
Listen to me. I was a medic in Vietnam. I know who's dying and who isn't. My daughter was not that sick. Somebody in that emergency room did something that killed her.
Executive producer Dick Wolf created Law & Order 2 decades ago, after working on Miami Vice and other TV crime shows. In 2003, he spoke to Terry Gross.
One of the things that's pretty consistent in the writing, in, stylistically and content-wise, is that you don't find out much about the private lives of the detectives or the prosecutors. It's really driven by the story. Why did you make that decision?
The wonderful thing about procedurals is that it does away with the necessity for soap opera. In other words, when you're not dealing with the personal lives of the characters, you can concentrate on the story. You can tell a complete story with a beginning, middle, and an end. And it's quite efficient in terms of dealing with complicated issues, dealing with moral issues that, we've been saying the same thing for years, that the first half is a murder mystery and the second half is a moral mystery. So it's how do you keep those elements unpolluted by the sex lives of the characters or going home with them. They're workplace shows, and I think that there is a fascination of just watching people at work without those sideline distractions of their personal lives.
And, you know, another thing the shows have in common, you've tried to do away with, you know, the establishing shots. You say you don't really want to spend a lot of time with the characters, kind of getting from one scene to another, getting in and out of rooms. What are some of those things that you wanted to kind of streamline or just take out altogether and just keep the action going?
That's you've annotated several of them already. That I think that one of the realities is that there is enough information in either side of the show to make a completely satisfying hour cop show or a completely satisfying hour legal show. The fact that you have to give what in many cases is twice as much information in the same 43 minutes that you have in a character-driven show, to tell this much story, you don't have time to go home with the characters. I mean, the pace of the show, the average hour show has about 26 scenes per episode. Law & Order usually has between 40 and 42. So that's a huge differential in terms of the pacing and in terms of the way scenes are structured on the shows.
One of the things you have to do every week is cast a dead body.
And,
you know, actors like to come in and show you their stuff. How do you audition to be dead?
It's a very, very complex process because everybody wants to be the dead body. It's the only thing that I'm constantly getting requests to be from people that, you know, can I be the dead body? And it's highly sought after because you can't be cut out. So it's a great gig for extras.
Have you become, I don't know if there's a word for this, somebody who hangs out at crime scenes and...
No, I don't. That's a level of, I guess, buffdom that... No, I've spent an inordinate amount of time with cops, but not really at that many crime scenes in the last 15 or 18 years. I used to go to them a lot when I was starting out writing this stuff.
How would you go? Did you have a police band radio?
No, I had a couple of homicide cops in L.A., and one of the aims was to see one of every kind of crime or one of every kind of murder. You know, that there was, it was an open call if there was a shooting, stabbing, garroting, something that was a little unique. Stan White or his partner would call, and we'd go out and see it. And I think the strangest crime scene I ever went to was on Super Bowl Sunday about 15 years ago, and I got a call from Stanley to meet him in Bell, which is one of the worst sections of L.A., and I walked in, and it was this apartment that was in kind of a motel complex, and there were three uniformed cops sitting on the sofa in this apartment watching the Super Bowl, and I was saying, God, this doesn't look like a crime scene, and then I walked 2 feet further in, and there was a body inside the closet, upside down, wrapped up in telephone cord with his eyes open, watching the game along with the cops. It was these three cops sitting there, absolutely no interest in this body 2 feet away from them, but they were into the game.
Did you go to these crime scenes with two different mindsets, one being, this is really horrible, this is tragic, this is the end of a life, and the other being, this is really interesting, let me study what it looks like so I can, you know, accurately render it in my series?
Unfortunately, I wish I'd had the former thought occasionally. It was always the latter. This is kind of interesting. There's no personal involvement. It's how cops do it. You know, that it's almost like coming in. You're almost seeing a movie when you go to these things because they can be so horrific. But there is, if you're a writer, certainly, and you're interested, there the attraction far outweighs any kind of moral quandaries that you might find yourself in.
I'm sure you'd seen a lot of crime in movies and television and read a lot of books with crime. What were there some things that just really astonished you about how real murder looks?
Yeah, it's a lot bloodier than we showed on television.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the one of the things that probably, unfortunately, most people who tell you that have gone to a crime scene is they're, it's surprising how much blood there is in a human body. It's much worse than we've ever shown on the show.
And when you actually saw these real murders, was there anything that surprised you about the faces, the expressions on the victims' faces?
Well, the guy in the closet looked quite surprised.
Mm-hmm.
But he was upside down, so I don't know, you know, what lividity has to do with that. But there are,
right.
I would say that people kind of say, if there was one expression, it wasn't pain. It was kind of like, what happened? It's, you know, surprise.
Right.
I don't think people usually expect to get shot. It's also one of the things that most cops will tell you that the most common thing is never ask to be shot because a lot of drunken altercations and a lot of street confrontations, somebody pulls a gun and somebody else says, oh, yeah, you're so tough, go ahead and shoot. Okay. And homicide cops will tell you the number of people, the number of killers that they've arrested to say, well, he told me to shoot him.
That's really interesting because
yeah.
In a lot of crime movies and TV shows, somebody who is kind of tough and challenging and sometimes the hero himself or herself will say, yeah, go ahead and shoot me. And then the person gets really weak and because the hero is wise enough to know that the person doesn't have the courage to do it. And that's
One homicide detective told me it is the single most common line in homicides.
Wow.
Go ahead and shoot.
That's really, really interesting. And that makes me think, too, about the kind of wise guy language that a lot of people use in TV shows and in movies. Smart aleck stuff, where somebody's mm-hmm. got a gun on you and you're quipping.
Oh, yeah. No,
bad idea in real life?
It's not a smart thing to do. You know, the best solution to anybody having a, if you ever have a gun pointed at you, give them whatever they ask for immediately.
Including some respect?
I'd be polite.
Right, right. How does this affect the dialogue that you write and the dialogue that you edit for Law and Order?
Well, you see, it's not really much of a problem because by the time the show starts, they're already dead.
Yeah, but there's still other, you know, the cops, the detectives are hunting for the killer, and they sometimes get in tough situations, and friends of the victim sometimes get in tough situations, too.
Yeah, I think it's much more, I mean, the hallmark of, and Jerry is the one who said this, that Law and Order is kind
Jerry
of like
Orbach?
Jerry Orbach is kind of like a Catholic high mass, that it's a rite, that the audience knows what's going to happen. Not in terms of the storytelling, but that there is a rhythm to the show, and I'd say one of the rhythms that is now part and parcel of it is Jerry's kind of mordantly acerbic comment at the end of the teaser, which has become part of just sort of the Law and Order mantra, that there is a setup line, and then Jerry gets to get the last line in the teaser, which invariably is kind of a... either acerbic, sarcastic, or insightful comment about the stupidity of murder.
Law and Order, one of the things it's known for is that a lot of the shows are, you know, the kind of, quote, rip from the headlines type of shows, where they're based on actual news stories.
No, they're not based on there. We steal the headline, but not the body copy.
Oh, really?
Yeah. No, I mean, if you actually have knowledge of any of the cases that, as they unroll, you go, oh, that's that case. It never is. That's the headline, the top of mind awareness is what we're after, and then the reality is most real life murders take a very predictable road to fruition. That they most murders are solved within the first 48 hours, and most people are convicted. That does not give you the twists and turns that make for an entertaining hour of television.
Now, I know you worked in advertising before you started working in television. You worked doing advertising mostly for Procter & Gamble products like Crest and Scope.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Would we know any of the campaigns you did for Crest or Scope? Did you write any of the jingles or slogans?
Scope fights bad breath without giving you medicine breath. There's one of the undying...
Oh, medicine breath. That was yours.
Yeah, and then National Airlines, which was... probably the most controversial campaign that I was ever involved with, and I'm sure you're too young to remember, but it outraged.
Oh, try me.
Try me? Fly me. I'm Cheryl. Fly me. Remember National Airlines?
Well, that was, Fly Me was yours?
Yeah, that's a long time ago. That's over 30 years ago now.
Oh, that was controversial because of, for feminist reasons.
Yes, it was.
Right.
That was the
it sounded like a sexual
feminism.
Innuendo.
Well, it was.
So much of advertising was then. I mean, a lot of advertising still is, but it was all more innuendo than overt.
It was very, very direct innuendo because they had a very specific goal in mind, that National Airlines had by far the highest percentage of business travelers in the early 70s going to Florida, and the reason was the stewardesses. That was the age of mini skirts that were so short that the stewardesses were not allowed to bend over in the cabin. They had to sort of do a semi-curtsy when they were serving people. And National really wanted a campaign directed at businessmen about the stewardesses. So it may have lacked some subtlety, but it did get talked about.
Law & Order creator Dick Wolf speaking to Terry Gross in 2003. Today we're saluting Law & Order, which has been canceled after 20 years. For many of those years, the most popular actor on the show was Jerry Orbach, playing quintessential New York detective Lenny Briscoe.
What is it? A drive-by? A hit?
A ladder. Right through the neck. Hit the carotid artery. No line. No waiting. You're gone.
Let's get him up.
Got it?
14 years old.
Pretty soon we'll be passing out vests in kindergarten.
Terry spoke with Jerry Orbach in 1989, asking about one of his other memorable cop roles.
You co-starred in the film Prince of the City. I really consider that movie to be your movie. You play a corrupt cop who won't cooperate with a commission investigating members of a narcotic squad on the take.
Right.
Let me play a scene from it.
You indict me on a squawk of a dope dealer who tried to buy me out of a
bust. You want to break up another federal operation that'll put away more quality mob guys in a year than you'll touch in your whole pissant career?
Detective Levy, you're hardly in a position...
I'll tell you what I'm in a position to do, and that's throw you out the window. It's only the fifth floor, but I'll try to aim you so you land on your pointed little head.
Levy, you can easily avoid trial. All you have to do is cooperate.
It. You got your mind made up to try me? Go ahead and try me. But not for a lousy $400. At least get me for assault.
Now, in this scene where you've just overturned the investigator's desk, it's very menacing.
Yes.
In that scene. Did you feel well-suited to that kind of menacing performance?
Oh, I love it because, you know, in real life, you can't go around throwing people's desks over and hitting them or kneeing them in the groin. You'll get sued. So to play that kind of a scene is a wonderful release for anybody. Because we have so many frustrations. There are people we'd like to hit, but we can't really do that. Also, it was a great release for the audience because in Prince of the City, the prosecutors are very dry and very nasty and, you know, they just don't give an inch to anybody. And it was sort of, the audience got its revenge on those guys for a minute there when I did that. It was a release for the audience.
You actually got your start in musicals. As a matter of fact, why don't I play something here from 42nd Street?
I'm sorry, show business isn't for me. I'm going back to Allentown.
What was that word you just said? Allentown? I'm offering you a chance to star in the biggest musical Broadway scene in 20 years, and you say Allentown? Come on along and listen to the lullaby of Broadway. The hip hooray and ballyhoo. Lullaby of Broadway. The rumble of the subway train. The rattle of the taxis. The daffodils who entertain at Angelo's and Maxie's when a Broadway baby.
I've read about you that your heroes when you were getting started were James Dean, Marlon Brando, Montgomery Clift. They didn't do musicals with the exception of Brando's Guys and Dolls. Was it your ambition to do musicals when you were starting out?
It's funny. I always sang, and I came to New York after I got out of Northwestern. I was a very serious young actor and did study with Lee Strasberg, Herbert Berghoff, Mira Rostova, worked at the Actors Studio. But the first job I got in New York was to replace the street singer in Threepenny Opera. I actually then replaced McHeath, Mac the Knife, for about 6 months, worked with Lenya and everything. I went from 3 years, 3.5 years in the Threepenny Opera to originate El Gallo in the Fantastics. And I just kept going from one show to another, from one musical to another, and it was a terrific life. My kids were being born, and I was raising a family in New York. And all my friends who couldn't sing, who were desperate and out of work, couldn't get a job off Broadway or anything, all went to Hollywood. And some of them became big stars out there. And that's sort of what I had wanted to do, you know, in the background. I'd always wanted to do that, work in film. And it just didn't seem to work out that way. I kept working, and it was all right.
What kinds of roles did you think you were heading for when you were getting started? What did you think that your specialty was going to be?
I really didn't. No, I didn't have any kind of a specialty. I thought I'd be a leading man, you know, and I was never a juvenile, even when I was 19 or 20. I mean, at 20, I was playing Mac the Knife opposite Lenya, which was outrageous. You know, I had no business being there. But I never looked like a kid. So it took me till I was into my mid-20s to start to really get the roles that I looked like. You know, I should have been 30, 35 playing them.
Did that seem like a hardship at the time, that you didn't look like a kid when you were a kid?
I don't know, not really. But sometimes I'd think, you know, the sort of Tab Hunter, Tony Curtis types, you know, I said, well, I can never compete with them, you know, back in the late 50s, because I was a little offbeat.
But of course, then their careers sometimes end early because...
Yes, I found that out.
Yeah.
Longevity is in being a character, man. Somebody said, are you ever going to retire? I said, no, I want to be like Melvin Douglas playing the grandpa on my deathbed when I'm about 85. That would be a pleasure.
Thanks.
Okay.
For doing the interview.
It's a pleasure.
Jerry Orbach speaking with Terry Gross in 1989. Orbach died in 2004 at the age of 69. We'll continue our Law & Order salute in the second half of the show. You can find links to interviews with actors who have starred in other Law & Order programs, including Richard Belzer and Ice-T, at our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air. Here's Jerry Orbach singing from the original Broadway cast recording of Promises, Promises back in 1968.
Promises, promises, I'm all through with promises, promises now. I don't know how I got the nerve to walk out. If I shout, remember, I feel free. Promises, promises end. I won't pretend that what was wrong can be right. Every night I'll sleep now, no more lies. Things that I promised myself fell apart, but I found my heart.
We're saluting NBC's original Law & Order, which is leaving TV after 20 years on the air. Our next guest is Esapatha Merkerson, who plays Lieutenant Anita Van Buren. Terry spoke with her in 2006. Here's a clip from an episode in which she recognizes a dead body as the daughter of a close friend. The initial suspicion is suicide, but Van Buren suspects something else and visits the girl's mother.
Maybe it's for the better if this just went away.
Christine, I'm going to tell you, I'm having trouble understanding your reaction to this.
It didn't happen to you, Anita.
No doubt. But I think you know something, and you're afraid to tell me.
I understand police procedure. I understand you need to ask me these questions.
No, I'm not here as a police officer. I'm here as your friend.
Then as my friend, please leave this alone and let us heal.
He's a serial abuser, Christine. He's gonna do it again.
Not here, he won't. And you don't understand because it's not your child at risk.
And Emily doesn't deserve more? Or are we not just talking about Emily here?
Please, just let this go.
Christine, has he made threats against Callie, too?
I can't do this.
Did he call here?
Anita, I can't lose another child.
And you won't if you let me put this man away. But girl, you got to come clean.
Why are you all over me?
You remember when I was a rookie and I wanted to quit because of all the crap I was taking on the job? Well, you said to me, don't let them beat you. And the reason I hung in was because you wouldn't let me give up, and I'm not gonna let you give up now.
What did you know about your character when you first got the part?
You know, the interesting thing is I knew nothing, and it happened quickly. I mean, literally, I got the job on a Friday, and I started working on a Monday. Because that whole thing about NBC asking Dick to bring women on happened, I believe, at the last minute. So I literally
wait. What
had,
whole thing about asking him to
bring
women
on? They were going to cancel Law and Order, and I think in its third season, because NBC wanted women on the show. So Dick let two of the guys go, and he brought on two women. That's how Jill Hennessy and I ended up on the show, because NBC was going to cancel it if he didn't bring skirts in. It was really that simple. They didn't believe that the show could last without women on it. I don't think it was any, you know, really heavy thought other than a skirt.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
But what happened was when the show went to syndication, that's when our demographic changed, because there are a lot of women who were at home. And then we started getting more women viewers. So with the change in bringing women and going to syndication, it really did change the demographic of the show. But when I first started, I literally just hit the ground running. I wasn't able to even talk to any lieutenants until after my first episode because we were so busy, you know, shooting the show. I really don't think anyone other than Dick was very clear about who this person was. And he did give me a biography of who he thought Van Buren was. And she came from a small family. There was no one in her family who was in law enforcement. It was something that she wanted to do. She's the kind of woman who shoots straight from the shoulder. And that was sort of a basic hit the ground running. And then I had the opportunity to meet a couple of female lieutenants. And the interesting thing is when I started, I believe there were only five in Manhattan. There was one lieutenant who was so cool. When you saw her, she literally looked like, you know, someone's aunt or, you know, sweet mother. But the minute she walked into the precinct, you knew she garnered serious respect from the guys that worked for her. And it was so cool watching this change from meeting her outside, walking through the precinct, and then going to her office. And when the door closed, we were giggling like a couple of girls. Someone would knock on the door. Her whole demeanor would change. It was really interesting having the opportunity to do that.
Esapetha Merkerson speaking to Terry Gross in 2006. Law and Order lasted 20 years on NBC, tying Gunsmoke as the longest-running primetime drama series. This weekend marks the 100th birthday of bandleader and clarinet player Artie Shaw, one of the true jazz greats. In the 1930s and 40s, his band ranked in popularity with the Goodman, Dorsey, and Miller bands. The Shaw Band made one of its most popular records at its first recording session in 1938. It was a song by Cole Porter called Begin the Beguine. Artie Shaw began his career playing with dance bands. He grew contemptuous of the band's crowd-pleasing antics and their trite music. When he organized his own big band in 1938, he rejected many of the pop tunes that had become dance band staples. He instead created a repertoire of original compositions while also performing songs from composers like Cole Porter, George Gershwin, and Irving Berlin. His huge popular success brought unexpected torments, including a reluctance to pander to audiences, and he quit the music business several times, sometimes for decades at a stretch. No matter how many times I hear Begin the Beguine, it makes me smile. But it turns out that wasn't Artie Shaw's reaction. When Terry Gross spoke with him in 1985 and played him a recording of his most famous song, he winced. Terry asked him why.
Well, because I've played that thing probably, I don't know how many thousands of times by now, and it's got to the point where it's fine to have a hit record. It pays rent, but it can drive you crazy, like an actor playing the same part. You know, a lot of actors don't mind that, but it can drive you nuts. I mean, Bogart became a caricature of Bogart after a while. And I get tired of that. I don't like being stereotyped. So I made maybe 500 records. Why Begin the Beguine? All right, it's a good piece, a good arrangement. But my God, I don't want to be characterized as only Begin the Beguine. That's what people seem to think is all I ever did.
It became the song that you were probably most associated with. How did you choose it? How did you choose to record it? It wasn't a popular song.
No, it was a flop. It was one of Cole Porter's few flop tunes and from one of his very few flop shows, Jubilee. I happened to get to the theater on Friday. The show closed Saturday. And I just heard that tune, and it was done in a kind of Latin beat. And I liked the melody. It was a hell of a good song. It still is. And a very big departure from most popular songs of those days, which were 8-8, Bridge and 8, or 8-8 and then 8-8. I mean, 1-2, 1-2. So I heard the tune, and I came back. I was looking for an identity for the band. I told you we were looking for good songs from sophisticated songwriters. So I said to Jerry Gray, let's do Begin the Beguine. He didn't know what the tune was. We got a copy, and we sat down and worked out the arrangement that everybody now knows. And I had no idea it was going to, you know, the other side of a record that we thought was going to be the big one. It's always been true. Fantasy was the other side of a record we thought was going to be a big one. Nobody knows what's going to be the hit.
The early bands that you played with were bands that you called entertaining bands. Like,
that's all there was. Yeah. There were no jazz bands then that you could make a living in. I mean, if you were lucky enough to be black, you could play jazz, because that's the only music they had in the ghettos. But I was playing in the white world. And in the white world, there was no room to play jazz and make a living. So I ended up at the best jobs there were, studio work. And there it got to be utterly incredible. You were playing things like Manhattan Merry-Go-Round, the Lucky Strike Hit Parade. Well, that's scary. You're playing as a true for true what they like. What was it true what they say about Dixie for 13 weeks in a row? That can be enough to drive any halfway decent musician clear out of his head.
You had said that when you were playing for the entertaining bands that you started to really hate the whole concept of showmanship.
I still do.
What were the kinds of showmanship antics that people in the band were called on to perform?
Glenn Miller's band waving the trombones around from side to side as they play, saxophones holding their instruments up in the air and doing everything but playing serious music. The guys in my band one night, I came back to the band. I'd left them for about 3 weeks. They were out on the road. And they were playing a tune that I wrote for the band called, an arrangement I made called Lady Be Good. At the end of the last chorus, the band does something, the saxophones do a fast kind of whinny trill. And the guys, for kicks, were holding their horns up, and the trombones were doing that. And I looked at them, and I was appalled. I said, what are you guys doing? They said, oh, it's for fun. I said, the audience doesn't know it's fun. They think you're doing showmanship. And if we have to do showmanship, that means we're very insecure about the music. Sit down and respect what you do. If you don't, they won't. And they heard that.
When you finally assembled a big band of your own, and I'm referring now to the second big band after the one with the string quartet in it, what did you do with that band to differentiate yourself from the kinds of pop bands that you were bored and disenchanted with?
Yeah, that's a reasonable question. It's got a reasonable answer. All right, we had a big band. Most of the then big bands that were playing what they thought was jazz were playing pretty much Ida, Avalon, whatever those songs, That's a Plenty, King Porter Stomp, blah, 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 blah. All the so-called jazz literature. I decided that there were some great compositions being written by American popular composers like Kern, Gershwin, Porter, Rogers, name it. These were the great composers in America, and they had written at a level of sophistication for the musical comedy, which wasn't, quote, dance music, but it was repertoire, you know, music that had to do with advancing the cause of a book or a story. So I found songs like Begin, songs like, Yesterdays of Kern's, What Is This Thing Called Love? All of that repertory. I decided to play the best music written by the best American composers, and instead of imposing a, quote, style, end quote, on it, play the piece in the manner that would best enhance that particular piece in a way that the composer might not have realized he had written. I tell my audiences now, we play Softly's in the Morning Sunrise. That was a piece written for an operetta called New Moon, Sigmund Romberg. I knew Rami. He was a nice guy, and he was a big, lusty Viennese guy who wrote American music. He came over here when he was a young man. He learned to write the American popular idiom, but he was writing operetta. And we wrote the piece. We played it in a quite different manner. And when Rami heard it, he called me up. He said, Artie, I think I like it almost better than the way I wrote it, which I considered a high compliment from him because he was a scrupulous craftsman.
My guest is Artie Shaw. When you were leading a jazz band, the bands were still pretty segregated. There were black bands and white bands.
In New York City, there was a local union, 802, white. Then there was a Harlem union for blacks. There was no way if you could mix. The only thing you could do on records now and then, you'd play with a black guy. I'd get on a record. There would be Coleman Hawkins there or Lester or whoever, Cozy Cole playing drums. Rarely was there a white. Well, there were no black playing with white musicians. Matter of fact, when I hired Billie Holiday, boy, was that not a scandal. It was amazing. I must have been very naive or else I had my head buried in what I was doing. I had tunnel vision. When I hired her because she was sincerely, for me, a sincere attempt to get the best singer I could get. But she joined the band, and it was a very, very strange experience. I'll tell you another story you won't believe. This is in a documentary film that some woman did about me, a woman named Bridget Berman. It's a film called Artie Shaw, Time Is All You've Got, which is a quote from one of our interviews. At the time I hired Hot Lips Page for the band, that was 1941 or something like that. just before World War II, before Pearl Harbor. We were supposed to do a very lucrative tour of the South. My agent gave me the figures and the times and so on. It sounded okay, so I signed contracts. He came back a couple of weeks later, very, very pale. He said, I don't know what we're going to do about this. Already we're in real trouble. I don't think they're going to accept what you're doing. I said, what are you talking about? He said, well, they want to cancel the tour. I said, why? He said, well, you got Lips Page in there. They want you to put a white guy in there. I said, forget it. Then they could tell me what kind of a band I'll have. This is my band. They want to hire us. They take what I got. So he went away very he's chagrined because there was a lot of money in it. Came back about 3 or 4 days later, said, I think I got it solved. I talked to some of them. One guy came up with a suggestion that could solve it. I said, what's that? He said, you can play the tour, use Lips Page, but he can't sit nearer than 15 feet from the nearest man in the band. I said, you mean I'm going to have three trumpet players over in one place with the band, and he's going to sit in a little chair all by himself way over there, 20 feet away? Yeah, I said, forget the whole tour. We canceled the tour. You believe that? That's only, 40 years ago. Few years ago. We made some strides.
Well, when you hired Billie Holiday, she was, I believe, the first black singer to perform with a white
band.
Well,
to work in a white band, steadily, sure, as a member of the band. She didn't come out as a specialty act. See, I mean, when Benny Goodman had, say, Lionel and Teddy Wilson, they came out as a separate thing. They weren't in the band. When I had Lips Page, he sat in the band. Roy Eldridge was in the band. I had Zooty Singleton in my band in 1937. Well, that was unheard of. We played the Million Dollar Pier. People said, isn't he a black man? I said, well, he's hardly that tan. But it was very, very nip and tuck. People used very, very angry at it.
Were there places you couldn't play with Billie Holiday?
No. We went to the South. That was difficult because Billie had a short fuse and people would say things about it and she would blow. So I always had a guy ready to spirit her away, put her in a bus and get her out because she would blow. She'd call a guy every kind of MF you could think of. And they didn't take that too well. See, they would refer to as, they would say, have the nigger wench sing another song. I couldn't believe my ears. I'd say, you mean Billie singing another song? No, the nigger wench. That's what they thought of her as.
You enlisted during World War II and ended up playing with your band on
the
Pacific Front. Yeah. Did you know when you enlisted that you'd be mostly performing? Was that the arrangement that was made?
No, I had no idea what I was going to be doing. I was on the stage in Providence, Rhode Island, when I went back in the wings while a dance act went on. We were doing an hour show, as they called it. And the stagehand's radio was on, and we were hearing a hysterical announcer talking about the Japs having bombed Pearl Harbor. Well, Pearl Harbor sounded like some sleepy little atoll out there in the South Pacific. I didn't know that Pearl Harbor was our principal naval base in the Pacific. But he sounded hysterical, and World War II had begun. I had to go back out on stage. Just before I went out, I got a note from the manager. Please announce that all military personnel is to report to its bases immediately. This was right near Newport, where there was a sub base, a naval base, an Air Force base, all that. So I went out on stage and did that, and about three quarters of the house got empty. And as the band started playing, I turned to Les Robinson, who was in the first row, saxophone players. He was the lead. And I said, Les, pass the word, 2 weeks' notice. Total impulse. And 3 weeks later, I was down on Church Street enlisting in the Navy. I just felt that there was no place for me as a civilian. This was the big experience of my life. Had to be part of it. I joined the Navy, and I went in as an apprentice seaman, as low as you could get. I could have become a commander if I'd wanted to. I didn't know that. I knew Forrestal, who was then undersecretary. And when I joined up, I had seen him, and he said, if you get in trouble, come see me. Well, after about 6 or 8 weeks of minesweeper duty or Staten Island, this, that, and the other, I found myself doing what an apprentice seaman does. I thought the Navy would have enough rationality to put me into the job I could do best for them and then give me whatever rate or rank I needed for that. I was very naive, you know. I didn't realize that the military service doesn't operate rationally. They looked at one stripe or no stripe, and they gave me a swab the deck sailor. Well, that's kind of stupid. I was building shelves under a stairway to put mops and buckets on. So I went to see Forrestal. I went AWOL, went down there and saw him in his office. And he laughed, and he said, all right, I'll put you in touch with somebody. And I got in touch with the head of enlisted men, a man named Admiral Bledsoe. And he gave me carte blanche to get a band together. He said, what do you want to do? I said, what do you want me to do? He said, get a band together. It's the best you can do for us. Where? I said, where's the Navy? He said, in the Pacific. I said, okay. So he gave me total carte blanche. I enlisted a bunch of guys who were 1A and got the best band that ever was. That band was a tremendous band. We won the Esquire Poll and all that. We traveled all over the Pacific in places where the Bob Hopes couldn't go. We went to forward areas. We were on battleships. We were on aircraft carriers. We were all over the place.
In the 30s and early 40s, a common question that people would ask was, well, who do you think is really the king? Is it Artie or Benny? Were you aware of that whole public competition?
How could
between
I not be?
Benny?
I was part of that controversy. That it makes no bloody sense. We weren't doing the same things. The fact is we played a clarinet. We each played a clarinet. But the music was different. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you an interesting little anecdote. I had occasion to talk to Benny about something once that I wanted to do, and I needed him, and I needed the Dorsey people, and I needed the Stan Kenton and Guy Lombardo and all of the big band leaders. And I got okay from everybody. Goodman didn't want to do it. And he kept asking me questions about clarinet players. What do you think about so-and-so? What do you think about this guy, that guy? I said, this guy's too schmaltzy, that guy's too rigid, knowing what he expected me to say, and I was zinging him a little bit. And so I said, finally, Benny, you're too hung up on the clarinet. And he looked at me and says, that's what we do, isn't it? I said, no, I'm trying to play music. I'm not interested in clarinet. It's a means. It's an instrument. You use an instrument to do something with. And I saw a tiny light bulb go on in his eyes. I don't think he ever seriously considered the idea that the clarinet was a means, not an end.
Artie Shaw speaking to Terry Gross in 1985. This weekend marks the 100th anniversary of his birth. The current edition of the PRI show, Riverwalk Jazz, also is devoted to Artie Shaw. You can find a link to that program on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also hear some more Artie Shaw performances, including the song Any Old Time, featuring Billie Holiday. The Oath is a new documentary by filmmaker Laura Poitras, whose documentary My Country, My Country, about the U.S. occupation in Iraq, was nominated for an Academy Award. The Oath tells the intertwined stories of two men. One was Osama bin Laden's bodyguard and is now driving a taxi in Yemen. The other was bin Laden's driver and became the first prisoner detained at Gitmo to face trial by a military commission. David Edelstein has this review.
To understand the depth, the fullness, and the haunting ambiguities of The Oath, it's useful to know that the director, Laura Poitras, set out to tell a simpler story of someone, anyone, released from the U.S. detention center in Guantanamo Bay. A likely candidate was Salim Hamdan, one of that first wave of prisoners after 9/11, whom Bush administration officials described as the worst of the worst. For a short time, Hamdan had been Osama bin Laden's driver. But after 5 years of largely solitary confinement and periods of so-called extreme interrogation, the worst of the worst had given them little intelligence of value. He was, it seemed, a low-level employee, the lackiest of the lackiest. Hamdan's story could fill a movie, and Poitras does justice to the legal maneuvers that landed Hamdan v. Rumsfeld before the Supreme Court. But the center of The Oath turns out to be a man whom Poitras met in Yemen, and whose case is less clear-cut, Hamdan's brother-in-law, the man who recruited him for al-Qaeda, Abu Jandal. Jandal is a taxi driver now, as well as a father and an informal teacher. Young men sit in his living room to discuss the role of Islam in social justice. He's seen in interviews on Yemen television and on 60 Minutes with Bob Simon. He's a celebrity of sorts. He's also, there's no getting around it, a mess. A man so cautious, so broken down, so riven by contradictions, that it's hard to reconcile what he says from scene to scene. For 4 years, Poitras tells us, Jandal had been Osama's bodyguard, and beyond that, al-Qaeda's, quote, emir of hospitality, welcoming new members and gauging their level of commitment. A jihadist from the age of 19, when he'd gone to Bosnia, Jandal found bin Laden a warm father figure to young men who'd grown up without love. He took an oath to follow orders without question. But after spending 2 years in a Yemen prison, where he was when planes struck the World Trade Center, he emerged a different man. Why he was different is a knotty question. You have to watch and listen. Watch him shift and shake on Yemen TV when asked about his oath. Watch him maintain to Poitras that he never could have taken part in attacks on civilians, no matter what he'd swore, even if that means being declared by Al-Qaeda an infidel. Yet watch him later tell his young students it was good to hit the towers, important to humiliate America in the eyes of the world. For an hour, Poitras moves back and forth between Jandal and the driver Hamdan, whose U.S. attorneys win their Supreme Court case and who's then recharged under Congress's 2006 Military Commissions Act. As Poitras' camera roams the eerie, nearly empty Guantanamo grounds, we hear excerpts from Hamdan's letters to his wife and children, which are not so much angry as anguished and bewildered. And Jandal in Yemen is anguished too. He feels guilt for having recruited Hamdan, guilt when he sees Hamdan's wife and children. But there is another kind of regret. When he was with Al-Qaeda, he had dignity and strength. Now he can barely feed his family. This great documentary comes down to a revelation I don't want to spoil, but I'll say it involves an FBI agent named Ali Soufan, who interrogated Abu Jandal after 9/11 while he was in that Yemen prison. It was a long, nonviolent interrogation, 15 days, and it changed the course of the war in Afghanistan. We see Soufan, or rather hear him, since his face isn't shown, testifying later before Congress, speaking out against the torture of prisoners like the driver Salim Hamdan. "Look," he says, "at how much we learned from Abu Jandal without a drop of blood." And there is also the matter of the U.S. Constitution, to which Soufan says he swore an oath.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.